407, contact tower 128.15.
Caution, caution. Manual, fuel, manual, fuel.
I'm John Golia.
I'm Greg Fife.
And I'm Todd Curtis.
And we are the Flight Safety Detectives.
Between us, we have over a century of aviation accident investigation and safety experience to draw on as we discuss issues that affect all of us.
So we are qualified to share our perspectives on accidents and incidents and what can be learned from them for the future.
We're proud to say that we have two sponsors that really relate to the topic of aviation safety: the Professional Aviation Maintenance Association, or PAMA, and Avemco Insurance. Later on in the show, we'll tell you how you can get a 5% discount on your insurance just for listening to the show.
We don't just dissect the official reports. In every episode, we identify safety issues and take the mystery out of accident investigations.
So maybe pilots and their planes can have safer flights ahead.
Well, hello, Todd.
Hello, John.
How are you doing? I'm just back from a great jaunt.
Yes, indeed. Had a small, you know, little hop across the pond to Bangkok from here in San Francisco area. Had a lovely time there. And I got back. I'm totally over jet lag and ready to get back to the business of the day, which is talking about our favorite subjects.
All right. And I found one from one of our listeners sent it in. And I can see why he sent it in, because there isn't a lot of information available to what happened. There's a lot of speculation, and we are going to be speculating a little in this one because the information is so lacking in the report. And why don't we get right into it? And I thank our listener for sending in some possibilities for some events that we can dissect or talk about, because it certainly is a little bit of learning to be had from this one.
Yes, this was a December 5th, 2021 accident involving a Piper Navajo in Medford, Oregon. This occurred about 4:52 in the afternoon, which is about 12 minutes after local sunset. And it was a low visibility situation, roughly 200 feet from the ground to the lowest level of cloud. And the departure, and you'll see this on the screen for those of you watching the video version of this, the departure procedure entailed taking off, making a climbing right turn, and going past a non-directional beacon and going on the standard instrument departure. And interestingly, the pilot was asking the controller in the tower whether or not the controller would call their turn. The controller said basically, they don't quote him here, I'll just read exactly what's on here. The controller replied that he would not be calling his turn and that the pilot should fly the departure as published, making a climbing right turn to overfly the approach end of the runway.
The public docket for this accident had an audio recording of the tower conversation, and here's what was actually said.
Bravo 6-4, Bravo Romeo, negative, just fly the SID as published. Bravo 6-4, Bravo Romeo, you're going to make a right turn, climbing, and overfly the NDB, or the approach end of runway 14, which of course you can't see. So it's the NDB, using the NDB or your GPS, and then proceed to Brute intersection, and then proceed to Lynx, and then on course.
Roger, 6-4, Bravo Romeo.
And going back to another picture, if you look close, you can see that there's a very, very tight right-hand turn. It made a couple of circles, at least that's the ADS-B track, and crashed. The last ADS-B point was different from where the crash location was. It looks as though the aircraft literally did two circles, tight circles, before crashing. And be more specific, it took off from the runway, got up to about 350 feet above ground level, descended while increasing speed, was fairly low, almost hit the ground, went up again and somehow or another got into a situation where the airspeed decreased about 15 knots, which is well below stall speed. And this is an excerpt from one of the security camera videos. You can see at the beginning of it, the airplane was descending and then pulled up. There's no airplane visible for a few seconds. And the next thing you see, next time you see the aircraft, it's in a rapid descent going to the ground. Unfortunately, both people on board were killed. A little bit of background before we go into the weather situation and the other situation at that airport. This airplane had flown in a few days before. There was some sort of fuel problem, which was repaired. And when the aircraft was ready, the pilot and the passenger got into a car in Fallon, Nevada, drove about 350 miles. They averaged about 50 miles per hour and got there an hour or so before for pre-flight. The pilot would have had to leave at about 7, 8 o'clock in the morning in Nevada in order to get on that airplane to fly back to Fallon. And this is a 69-year-old pilot. We know nothing else about the person's medical situation. And it just seems to me that this is going to be a long day. You have a fairly long trip, even if you're a passenger, it's a fairly long trip in a car. Then you have to get to the airport, prepare for the flight, and be mentally prepared to take off in a low visibility condition just after sunset with a flight that would take roughly an hour, hour and a half, where you'll be landing in darkness. This is going to be a long day any way you cut it. And there's no indication here of any sort of medical issues. There's no indication from even the public docket. Did the person have a good set of days of rest before this, et cetera? So like John was saying, there's not a lot of information here. Another key point, and I'll go straight to the probable cause. Like I said, this was a low visibility situation. The airplane had their anti-collision lights on, and that was shown from the security camera video, which was in the public docket. We showed you one piece of one of those videos, and it was clear from reviewing those videos, the lights were flashing. The lights were working on the aircraft. It's also clear from the audio analysis that both engines were running, and they were stating that they were running roughly the same RPM. So it appeared that the engines were acting normally. And the probable cause was the pilot's failure to maintain aircraft control during the initial climb into clouds due to spatial disorientation, which resulted in an uncontrolled descent and collision with terrain. There was a descent into terrain, and the second descent was clearly uncontrolled. It was almost straight down. And as you can see from the picture we're putting on the video version of this, the aircraft crashed into a car dealership, had a very, very small footprint, looking like a very much a vertical descent into the ground. But the first time it dipped low to the ground, clearly it was under control because, as you saw from the video, it went down and then went up again, apparently back into the clouds, where something occurred and the aircraft ended going nose down. We looked at one of the public docket statements, and I'll be putting this on the video version as well. The aircraft had a flight on October 19th of 2021 from Santa Monica to Fallon, Nevada, which was the home base of this pilot. Did not fly again for about 35 days. It was the 24th of November that it flew from Fallon to Medford, Oregon. That's where it had the fuel problem. And it was repaired there. And roughly 11 days later is when it took off on the accident flight. So in the last, essentially, 1.5 months, this airplane had flown three times. The pilot, who was the accident pilot, flew it on those last three missions. There's no indication whether or not this pilot flew any other kind of aircraft. The pilot was very familiar with this aircraft, had bought it some years before. This is a person who's also instrument rated, so a fairly mature pilot, fairly experienced pilot, and it was this pilot's airplane, but not that much flying in the last couple of months.
So if we, you know, we speculated a little bit already, I mean, it doesn't make sense. So the NTSB had very, very little to work with this this accident. It seems like they did a basic sound analysis of the engines, which may or may not be totally accurate. I, as a mechanic, would immediately start raising concerns about the fuel system, you know, because more than once we've thought we fixed the system and we didn't. And they also make note in the report that the mechanic couldn't recall what position he left the fuel selector switch in. And that begs the question of a pilot that flies his own airplane and maybe make sure his fuel tanks have plenty of fuel in them, may have them selected on both, and the mechanic may have been selected on one. And if the pilot didn't check it, just assumed that he had it on both tanks, that could have led to some fuel starvation issues. There's a lot of unanswered questions in there, a lot of speculation for accident investigators or even insurance investigators who try to dig to the bottom of this. It's just a lot of unanswered questions about that initial part. And it gets to the point where I always talk about at the end of the show, doing a good pre-flight. You know, I've seen and flown with a lot of pilots that are the only ones that fly a particular airplane. It's their airplane. And that they leave all the switches in positions, and they very quickly, when they do a pre-flight, don't even check them because they're the only one flying the airplane and they're the only one touching the controls. And they go once over lightly with the position of switches and selector valves. So it's, you know, that's enough more speculation on my part, but that is a possibility for an accident that we have very little substance. And you're going to see a picture in here of the impact location. I mean, the nose and tail came together and it was a pretty good fire. So all the physical evidence is gone. So it's a very, very difficult accident to try to ascertain what the problem was with no physical evidence left. No transmissions from the airplane to the tower, the problems. When you overlay his flight path on a map, it sure looks like he was trying to get back to the airport. But again, that's speculation on my part because we have nothing to base that on other than the direction the airplane was going. You know, he gets off the ground, he starts to turn to the right, then he makes a really tight turn to the right and does a 360 and is coming out of it and heading in the direction back to the airport. So, you know, it just leads you to speculate that that's what he was trying to do, is get back. But since there was no physical evidence anywhere, we don't know if it was a fuel system, we don't know if a flight control problem, or any other problem. It's all speculation.
And before we get into some more of the speculation and more of the information from the public docket, I'd like to thank once again our subscribers. We love folks who subscribe to the channel. That helps us, and it helps you because it gives you access to benefits like early access to shows and other benefits to be named later. And not only do we thank our subscribers and want to have more subscribers, we'd like to have more sponsors. If you're a subscriber, there's an email across the bottom, Flight Safety Detectors. If you're a subscriber, we have the email flashing on the bottom, flightsafetydetectives.com. I did it again. I'm going to have a big graphic over this to unscrew this. If you want to subscribe to the YouTube channel, we have a graphic up here that shows you where you can go. Click on the subscribe button and follow the procedure, and you'll be a member of the Flight Safety Detectives team. And if you are a subscriber or not a subscriber, you can always write to us at flightsafetydetectives@gmail.com, where we answer your questions. And sometimes, like today's show, we get good ideas from our audience. And for those of you who'd like to sponsor some or all of what we do here, write to us at fsdsponsors@gmail.com. And we can have a conversation about how we can help you connect your service and your product with our audience. And getting back to some of the information that we do have from this accident, going through the public docket, one of the things they have is an article from Flight Safety Digest from 2004, which will be available on the webpage supporting this show that talks about Flickr vertigo. And vertigo, many causes of it. You basically have a confusion between what your body's telling you and what you're seeing. And one of the reasons why instrument pilots are basically taught to rely on the instruments, even if your body is telling you something different, because sometimes, especially when you lose orientation with the ground, which can happen at night over a dark, light-free area like a lake or an ocean, it could happen in clouds. And this was a situation where shortly after takeoff, this aircraft would have been in clouds. And in this particular case, the NTSB said that the pilot may have been suffering from Flickr vertigo. Now, why do they say this? There were anti-collision lights that were on the aircraft that were operational during that short flight. And this is something where the airplane operating manual suggested that you not do this in clouds because of this particular hazard. And when you have that sort of situation, you're surrounded by a cloud, like being in a fog bank, and you have these anti-collision lights blinking, and it can confuse you as to what's going on outside. Can't say he was, because we have no audio from inside the cockpit. We just have the indirect evidence that the anti-collision lights were on, and the aircraft did not have any major mechanical issues, although I will say this. The NTSB report did not say there were no non-mechanical issues in the aircraft, because again, there's really no evidence left, no cockpit voice recorder, no communications. So we can only speculate that there may have been some other issues with the aircraft that were not discernible after looking at the wreckage. But again, we don't have a whole lot to go on. But when you do visit the site, the page for this episode, rather, download that article and have a look at it. You might learn a thing or two.
Hello, aviation enthusiasts, safety professionals, and curious minds. Welcome to Flight Safety Detectives. We are thrilled that you dropped by. Here, we dive deep into the world of aviation safety. From incident investigations and technical analysis to lessons learned and what they mean for safer skies. As a member of our channel, you get exclusive member-only perks, first access to new episodes, live stream discussions, and Q&A sessions. We are a community of fellow safety detectives who love aviation as much as you do. If you're passionate about aviation or just curious about how things work, we'd love to have you on board. Hit join, ring the bell to be notified, and jump into the discussions in the comments. Strap in, because together we're going to explore aviation safety like never before.
The fire was intent, according to the physical evidence. There's not much of aluminum left at all, so everything else was totally consumed in the fire. But you know what? One thing that always struck me, that if I was back flying again, I would certainly have some one of these modern, very small flight data recorders that you actually can stick on your instrument panel with Velcro. We've seen a number of those out at Oshkosh. Todd, you and I walked around and talked to several manufacturers of these little devices that can help investigators after a fact determine the cause. You know, I for one wouldn't want my family to think that I was the cause of an accident, especially killing somebody else along with myself. I would like the truth to be known, and a little flight recorder of sorts can help a lot. Even the old handheld Garmin navigating system, you know, that hikers use. We oftentimes find those in airplanes to help us look at the pathway that the airplane was taking. There's lots of reasons, none of which would have helped this airplane if the fire was too big and too intense. which probably indicates he had plenty of fuel on board. The engine seemed to be, appeared to be running good, at least by sound. So it really defies description. The NTSB had next to nothing to go on here. We can speculate on fatigue. We can speculate on that position of the fuel selector switch. But it is all speculation. That's all we've done in this report so far, except for a few points like his age and the hours that he's flown. He just went through training at Simuflight. He spent 2 hours doing IFR training, 2 hours basic flying. I mean, the guy should have been qualified with all the hours that he has. It defies description to have an accident like this without there being a mechanical problem or a medical problem.
According to the accident report, the pilot had a total of 2167 hours, all aircraft, 1520 hours in this make and model, and 2089 hours as pilot in command. Had a commercial certificate, was a single-engine, multi-engine rated, and had a Class 2 medical certificate, which is higher than the class that I have. I have a Class 3. I'm not a commercial pilot. You have to go to a higher level to be a commercial pilot, which means he would have had a more frequent review with his physician, his aerospace medical examiner, than I would have. And again, the report didn't say anything about any medical conditions that may have been an issue here. There is nothing said about the person he flew with, whether this person was a rated pilot, whether this person had flown with them multiple times. So we don't know the role of the second person. And again, this is something where there's some information, but there's some things that we would love to have more information on simply not there. For example, there was something in the public docket where one of the people who knew him well for like 25 years was saying that when it comes to him communicating with air traffic controllers, he often asks for things to be repeated and for clarifications. And this accident report stated that he did so in this flight as well. But if we're taking the word of his person, his friend who knew him well, this was normal for this pilot. Again, every pilot is different. Some pilots want to be absolutely sure what they're hearing and make sure they're not misinterpreting. At the same time, this pilot is not unfamiliar with this airport. The pilot in previous years, this accident happened in December of 2021, but in August 2018 and August 2018 and 2019, he'd actually done two instrument departures from this airport, different departures from the accident one, but he's not unfamiliar with this airport. So whether it was a case of not having been there recently, whether it was a case of complacency, whether it was a case of there was actually an emergency going on for which we have no evidence because of the level of destruction and he was trying to do an emergency return, we don't know. Just going by what information we have, that's not much more. There's not more much more we can say.
Yeah, this is a tough one for everybody involved. Must be tough on the family to not having, there's absolutely no answers in this report. It's nothing but speculation on our part. It's not speculating in the report, but it's on our part trying to identify the pieces. And that's not what we like to do. We do not like to speculate. But when you try to decipher an accident like this with absolutely no factual or almost no factual information, it's difficult not to try to second guess. Was he returning to the airport? Did he have a problem with the fuel that didn't show up because of the sound that they were able to extract off the engines as they flew by? There's no answer. I mean, there's nothing to be said.
One other thing that I find interesting, only slightly interesting, because it's usually not a sign of a problematic investigation. At the end of the accident report under the administrative information section, it says that the original published date was December 14, 2023, just over 2 years after the initial accident, which is in the normal range. However, there was a revision date a year later, December 13, 2024. And, John, here's a question for you. How often do you see this sort of thing in a report? They publish it, and then there's a revision a year later.
Well, normally it would come with a question for reconsideration. So NTSB reports are never final. So even after they put out this final report, it's subject to change if something factual comes to light that's different. Now, the factual could be the family members or some other organization that's come forward with some additional information that wasn't available at the time of the initial report. Or sometimes NTSB themselves in the laboratory, and maybe they brought in some material or some other facts, you know, maybe some additional sound material, for example, a larger recording of the engine, and maybe that changed it. They don't identify what changed in this report. But there's any time that you can come up with factual information that was not included in the initial investigation, you can petition the NTSB to do a reconsideration, and they will put an investigator on it. And sometimes it takes a long time to do it, to get it done because of other workload. But they will go through it and often change reports. I was involved with several of them that I brought forward myself after visiting the accident site. I'm a nuts and bolts guy. So I would go out and maybe give a speech. In this case, I was out to do something in Arizona in the case that I'm talking about. And I talked to some people that had disagreed with the report. They identified to me that some facts disagreed with the report. And one of them was medical in nature. So I went back when I was back in Washington, I brought the material that they provided me into a doctor. The NTSB has a medical doctor. I don't know if they're still there. There was a position was vacant for a while. I don't know if it's filled or not. But anyway, at that time, we did have a doctor on staff. I brought the information into him and asked him to take a look at it. And after a short period of time, he came back to me and said, the report was wrong. I recalendered it, which means I asked for a re-review. We sat down with the staff, shared all the information, and the report was changed to reflect the finding, the medical finding, which exonerated the pilot, by the way. So now, NTSB reports are never final. They're always subject to revision. Some big ones like the United Airlines in Colorado Springs, and some maybe 8 or 10 years later, I forget the exact dates, so don't hold me to that. But years later, when we finally figured out what the cause of the USAF Flight 427 in Pittsburgh was with the rudder PCU, and then staff in the engineering department reviewed that compared to what happened in Colorado Springs and determined that the event in Colorado Springs was in fact similar to the one in Pittsburgh, and we changed the probable cause on that one in Colorado Springs. Now, I didn't participate in that because I had a relationship with USAF, so I get to watch that one from the sidelines. But the point is that if you have compelling new evidence, you can get a reconsideration of the probable cause.
Well, I think that is giving me an opportunity to do what I do every show. Give the second to last word. And the second to last word is, sometimes you don't have all the answers. Well, that's actually most of the time, but this time in particular, because there are gaps in the information, not for any reason because it was an incompetent investigation. I don't think that at all. It's just one of these investigations where there's not a lot of evidence to go on. There was nothing really outwardly obvious about the situation prior to the accident. There were things during the time of the accident which were circumstantial in nature. the weather, the anti-collision lights. So it's fairly straightforward, it seems, that this was the cause. But like you were talking about these other accidents, I don't think there will be much in the way of alternate evidence coming up later on to change the final result here. And unfortunate, but that's just the way it is with a lot of accidents.
Okay, and for a final word, I will do two pieces. First off, please excuse us for speculating so much. We engaged in this accident because of one of our viewers sent it to us, and we thought we would dig into it. And digging into it required us to do a lot of speculation, which we're not comfortable doing. But please understand that. And I will go to what I always say. If you're going to go flying, do a good trip, a case of pre-planning your flight. Do it at home. Do it again at the airport. Make sure they agree. When you get out the airplane, a good external and internal pre-flight. Don't assume that anything was left untouched from your previous flight. After you get in the air, please put that head on a swivel. I mean, there is so many new student pilots out there. And I'm at the FBOs, I can't count how many times I've heard them talking about airplanes being in a location they weren't supposed to be because of some student pilot got himself twisted around. So please, please pay attention out there for yourself and for the others that are flying. Please, please fly safely.
Thank you so much for listening to the show. We really value all of our listeners and subscribers. Our podcast gets ranked by you. So if you like this, give us 5 stars inside your podcast platform.
We want to keep the conversation going with you. So we'd love for you to engage with us on our social media channels. We're on Instagram, X, Facebook, LinkedIn, and of course, YouTube.
You can email the show at flightsafetothetexas@gmail.com. By the way, if you're watching this on YouTube, we're working on growing this channel, and it really helps if you all comment. So please do that. We read them all.
And be sure to subscribe.
For decades, Avemco Insurance Company has been an advocate for pilot safety by promoting and sponsoring continuous pilot training and education. One of their initiatives has been to reward pilots who actively participate in being more proficient with savings on their insurance premium through the Avemco Safety Rewards Program. Pilots save by earning new ratings, getting recurrent training, participating in the Fast Team Wing program, and listening to podcasts like ours and other Avemco-related courses and training. Call 888-879-0389 for a free quote or visit avemco.com/flightsafety. Don't forget to tell them the Flight Safety Detective sent you for an automatic 5% off.